whole rush of the Quill to Live and Tor.com and Forbes and many other ventures. You're a man of many, many ventures. We're here to talk about an adventure. In fact, multiple adventures in babysitting. 1987, directed by Gremlins director Chris Columbus, if you
also
can believe
Harry
that.
Potter 1 and 2, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's correct. This is the first time that you'd ever seen this film. Is that correct?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I say that as if like people should know why I'm laughing, as if it's some in joke, right? I didn't know this movie existed until you mentioned it to me about a month ago, you know, saying, hey, let's watch this. And here.
So knowing that this movie it turns 35 years old this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different kind of film, which in a lot of ways I was watching it. I haven't watched this in probably a decade or more. Part of me was like, wow, this is really cringe. And there's other parts of me that thought this movie kind of works for today in a lot of odd ways. But just as someone who'd never heard of this movie, never seen it, but is a giant Elizabeth Shue fan, what did you make of Adventures in Babysitting?
Well, giant's a bit of an overstatement. I couldn't tell you much of what she's been in, but every time I see her, I look up who is that, and then I'm like, oh, that's Elizabeth Shue. She's phenomenal. Most recent example being The Boys, despite how weird her role is in that show. Absolutely love her in it. But Adventures in Babysitting, what a fucking trip, man. Quite literally.
Wait, sorry, one second. I need to correct the record before the internet yells at me. Joe Dante directed Gremlins. Chris Columbus was a producer on Gremlins.
Gotcha.
So yes, it all
but he was the
out.
Director of Harry Potter 1 and 2.
Yes.
Very important.
Okay.
You know, get that right on the show notes.
Call off the pitchforks, gang. I'll put a little title in there saying skip to minute like 232 or whatever for the correction. All right, go ahead.
I don't know. It was like I watched this movie the day before we recorded this, and I was in a really weird headspace. I had watched the Bears game at a buddy's house, and I came home and gnarly was exhausted. And I was like, oh no, am I getting sick? And I was like, I'm just going to throw this movie on. And you may think that this is going to a place where the movie cures my ailments. That is not the case. I feel much better this morning after a good night's sleep. But I was just in this weird place of just like not feeling great. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to throw the movie on and see where it takes me. And for that, you know, hour and 45 minutes or whatever, I was in for the ride. I kind of just like, it was one of those where you don your suspenders of disbelief, as I call them, and you simply let the ride happen. And I enjoyed it. I think there are scenes in this movie that I thoroughly liked, and there are scenes that I could not tell you what happens whatsoever in them. But it's just kind of like,
is that because you forgot or they don't make any sense to you?
Well, I mean, I think both, you know. Some of the scenes are there just to be there and it makes them all the more fun, and some of them are just like, okay, now we're doing a Die Hard, I guess. But there's a lot to unpack in the movie, but I had overall a good time. I would say that my biggest question coming out of the movie was, how did this get made? Like, what what happened? Who read this script and was like, that's the movie? Because then I find myself asking, like, who is this movie for? And then the movie ends and I'm like, so the person I thought this movie was for, which is the Brad insert, you know, the guy who's in love with and wants to like prove himself to her, like, you know, the ending doesn't really resolve that storyline that I had expected. And I was like, okay, what's the purpose here? And I pondered this for all of 30 seconds after the movie was over, and then thought, you know what? I'm just going to let it be. I don't care how it came to be. It exists. I think it is a net positive for moviedom as a whole, but you know, it's not like my biggest recommendation to anybody. I think it'll be fun when I encounter somebody who has seen it and I can be like, I too have seen that movie, because I just don't think a lot of people around my age might have, because they were born around this time, but it's not like I've never heard of it, like I said, and I didn't know anybody else who had. So it's kind of like a cultural Easter egg for me now, I think. At least that's what I'm expecting of it.
Yeah, it's strange because I know I'm a generation, I think, removed from you, possibly two. And it was definitely a kind of a touchstone for certain people of my generation, and not just because it was a touchstone picture. But I, this was,
or maybe
this
only was, because of that.
Possibly. But no, this was one of those kind of holy grail movies from when I was 10 years old, because my parents didn't take me to see a whole lot of movies around that age. I mean, I saw, you know, some things here and there, but Adventures in Babysitting, it kind of had to be something that they would want to see, that they would also take me to see. And I don't think they had any interest in watching a movie called Adventures in Babysitting. This is probably before the Babysitter's Club, I imagine, maybe. So they probably thought it was just a bunch of girls having a sleepover or something. But so they did buy me the novelization, which I remember reading in class one day, like between tests. And I was imagining what the movie was based on what I'd seen of the trailer on TV. And kind of like, I knew who was in it. So I was reading the book and kind of playing the film out and, you know, in my head. And then whenever it came on video, like I think I rented it like a year or two later, I finally got to see it. And it was pretty much everything I had hoped it would be. But yeah, it just, I think it was because I didn't have that access and I had to use my imagination to kind of fill in what is this mythical movie that stars the cute girlfriend from The Karate Kid. And, you know, it takes place in Chicago, which I think that was the first time I'd really known about a movie taking place in the city that I was growing up next to. Yeah. So I love this movie. I hadn't watched it about 10 years, I think, as I'd mentioned, maybe even longer. But I busted out the Blu-ray. I watched it with my wife because we're both fans of the movie, but we hadn't watched it in a while. And there was some stuff, like I kind of hinted at earlier, Vincent D'Onofrio has never looked better when he shows up.
I don't even know who he plays, man. I saw his name at the credits and I was like, I didn't see Kingpin.
You didn't? Oh, do you know who it? Well, here's a great thing. He plays another Marvel character in this movie.
Oh, wait, that's Vincent. No way.
Thor, yes. The owner of Dawson's
Garage. You're
so
full of shit. There's no way.
Nope. I am not kidding. That is Vincent D'Onofrio about 35 years and about 3,500 pounds lighter. Which I just drew that Marvel connection. Yeah. Wow.
Thor, I only know him as Kingpin. Like, you know, and I love that series. I thought he's one of my favorite on screen iterations of Kingpin, as a matter of fact. Next to maybe. Spider-Verse, Into the Spider-Verse, love that version too.
Oh, yeah.
But holy crap, like that, I would never have put that together because I did see his name and I was like, I didn't bother to look at what role he played, which I obviously should have, but I was like, I don't remember him being in the movie at all. And I'm running back through like, was he some guy at the blues bar? What is this? But hey, good for him, man. You know, he is now unrecognizable and has played two Marvel characters, which most people can't say.
Well, it's funny because it was right around the same time he was in a Stanley Kubrick film called Full Metal Jacket, which he played a completely different part. Did you ever see that one?
I did not. I've seen Full Metal Alchemist.
Not quite the same thing.
I have a question for you before we like get into any of the minutiae.
Yeah.
Does the Blu-ray dub out a lot of the swears? Because asshole became airhead for me. Bitch became witch.
Did Disney you watch Plus, this on Disney Plus?
Disney Plus dubs out all of the good
stuff.
Yeah. So I was watching it and I didn't notice it until I saw Brad say asshole and it dubbed to airhead. And Aaron was watching just tangentially on the side doing stuff on her computer. She was like, is this dubbed over? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, is this on Disney Plus? And I go, yeah, that probably could have been your first question. So I wanted to call that out first thing.
Well, hold on. Let's the second thought you have, hold that in your mind because I don't want you to lose it. Because I had no idea. I almost watched this on Disney Plus because I'm like, I don't want to have to go all the way over to my shelf and pull down a movie. But
agreed.
Now I'm kind of glad that I had.
Ridiculous.
Seriously. But there's another line of dialogue I'm very curious about. Early on in the film, Brad is talking to his younger sister, Sarah. And he's teasing her about her obsession with Thor, the god of thunder, which comes in later to play later with Vincent D'Onofrio's character. But Brad calls Thor something and it makes Sarah really upset. In the version you watched, what did Brad call Thor?
I don't remember.
Because
I wasn't noticing the dubs until later.
Well, you might recognize this because it's kind of shocking again watching this in 2022, and my wife leaned over to me and said, canceled. Because Brad says Thor's a complete homo. Just quoting the movie here, folks. And then at the end, or
I don't think that's what he says in the Disney Plus.
Well, because it makes it doubly funny later on when they actually meet the Dawson character, because he looks like Thor from the comics. And Sarah says, my brother said you are a homo. And that's when Thor like grabs Brad by the scruff and says, you've been spreading rumors about me, kid.
Yeah, that I feel like I would have noticed that, and I did not. So I don't think that was what they said, but I can't for the life of me remember what they replaced it with.
I gotta watch the Disney Plus version. I gotta fast forward to that and see, because I'm curious what, I had no idea that they were editing the movies that they put on there. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but I figured, you know, they're putting it on Disney Plus. There's a reason people love these movies. They love them as is, right?
And it's like they've done other, you know, kind of title cards before about, you know, like racist or homophobic imagery or whatever. And Aaron and I literally talked about this. We were like, I'm surprised they didn't just put like a disclaimer that this includes language. Like,
right.
You know, and I guess for this movie, it's hard because babysitting is, I would assume that most viewers would connote a movie with babysitting in the title as being for kids, right? Like that's kind of, that might be the thought process behind these middle-aged white men in suits putting this stuff on streaming platforms. But I don't actually know. And I was like, any kid old enough and watching this is going to see that he said asshole and be like, well, why did they bother, you know, replacing it with Airhead? Like, it's kind of silly to me. And I don't have kids, so maybe you can talk about this, but how invested some of these like corporations get in not including this type of language or these swears and stuff. But what interests me more is that I believe they're doing it to limit parent outrage or outcry at this type of thing. And like, as a parent, would you say like you'd rather they just, you know, with the exception of some very specific words, right, like just say asshole, because like your kids probably hear it and say it, you know, when they're among their friends? I guess it depends on how old they are, but open-ended. Dude, question to you.
This podcast just became about something completely different, because now I'm thinking
adventures
about
in parenting.
Well, because this movie, I'm pretty sure, was PG-13, because Touchstone Pictures was like the PG-13 branch of Disney. Like, they wanted to do more, you know, not necessarily adult fare, but stuff that wasn't, you know, totally kid friendly.
Right.
They did a whole bunch of like, you know, crazy movies and stuff. But I got to ask you now about the train scene, and I'll get back to your point about being a parent and all that stuff. But at one point, the kids end up on a train on the L,
yep.
And there's two rival gangs that are coming, you know, in from opposite
the Jets
cars,
and the Sharks. Are,
yeah,
as
right.
I call them.
Here comes Devereaux. But at one point, Brad gets up in the face of one of the gang members because he insults Chris. First of all, he says, sit your ass down, bitch. Now, I don't know if you heard that coming out of your TV or if it's something like, sit your butt down, babysitter.
It's witch.
Wow.
And the whole thing, because they say bitch like 60 times in that scene. And by 60, I mean like 8. And they say witch every time.
Because this is where it really tested the bounds of the PG-13 rating, because I think you're allowed one F-bomb.
Right.
There's two in this movie in that scene.
There were not in the movie I watched.
Because at one point, the gangbanger says to Brad, don't fuck with the lords of hell. And he drops the knife.
Oh, it was
into...
fool.
Because he drops the knife into Brad's shoe. And then Chris, Elizabeth Shue's character, picks the knife up and shoves it in the gangbanger's face and says, don't fuck with the babysitter.
Don't fool with the babysitter.
No! Oh, yep. I am so sorry, Cole. If I had any idea, I would have insisted. Like,
I'm kind of happy about it, because this is some interesting fodder for discussion. And it's just like, it's just so silly that these choices were made to me. I just don't understand it. I'm 31 and I, you know, I swear all the time. So
it's partially to what you were saying as a parent, and I'm not every parent, but just my general philosophy. First of all, there's a weird moment, you know, if and when you have kids someday, there's going to come a point where your daughter or son, whatever, comes home from school and you want to have like this uncomfortable conversation about like language and like, you know, there's some words you shouldn't use. And they're going to turn to you and say, I already know everything, Dad. There's nothing you can
right.
Like, wait, you know the F word? He's like, yeah, there's a couple. You know the C word? Yeah, there's a few. And like, like, you know not to use them, right? And like, in front of you, yeah, right, yeah, no. Hey, we already talked about Misery. But no, it's as far as like, you can't, I mean, to the 80s were very different, so you could right. get away with having a family film where you've got this kind of language and all these crazy adult situations. I mean, the two biggest, or the three biggest brands in Adventures in Babysitting, if we're to believe this alternate reality, are like Coca-Cola, Thor from Marvel Comics, and Playboy Magazine. Is this like yep. everywhere?
I'd say two out of three are right, but who knows which?
Well, you can say bitch on the podcast. But it's...
Who knows bitch?
Right. But it's the thing is like, you don't want to see F-bombs in a PG-13 like kids right. movie. But, you know, and I don't know what the parameters are because I'm a pretty, you know, I grew up a pretty liberal guy as far as that stuff, mostly because I watched movies like Adventures in Babysitting, where it's like yep. by the time you're 8, 9, 10 years old, you've seen it all not only on the schoolyard, but on movies and TV. But there is some language like the word homo is not going to show up in any any content yeah. really, unless it's like a period piece and it's very clear that, you know, that is something that you don't say. In fact, I feel weird saying it now. Here's another thing about language. Why do I feel comfortable referencing that word? But if it were the other F word, as I like to call it, I would not say that.
Right. I don't have an answer for you.
I don't either. So
let's I remember.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, really quick, this is just like a super quick intercut, but I remember when I realized that it wasn't that big of a deal. I was in sixth grade, we were in study hall, and everybody had to bring a book to read. And I remember seeing the word hell in one of my books. And I turned to the kid next to me and I was like, look. And he looked and he was like, yeah, so? And at that moment, I was like, oh, fuck. Everybody knows these swear words. It's not just, I shouldn't be surprised to see them in the wild. And that was when I realized, cute. Like, yeah, I was pretty naive growing up. Like, it took me a while to learn some shit. But you know, much of it was, I was very privileged and had a lot of, you know, I didn't have to want for anything. But it also meant that I just did not learn a lot about a lot of stuff until a little later, which was kind of funny looking back, the stories about what I thought life was like as a child. So yeah, hell is allowed to be in books, as it turns out.
Amazing. This reminds me of another. It was around that same time. I think I was in fifth grade. I was obsessed with the movie Mannequin with Andrew McCarthy and Kim Cattrall, about a mannequin that comes to life and romances this store designer guy. It's a big comedy. But I used to, before I even saw that movie, there was a music video from Jefferson Starship. You know, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now. You may have heard this song. I don't know. It's really old. But I loved that. And Andrew McCarthy was in another movie the year after Mannequin came out called Less Than Zero. And my parents wouldn't take me to see that either, but they bought me the novelization. Turns out the novelization was the debut novel of Bret Easton Ellis, who wrote American Psycho. And so I brought that book to school to read one day, like between classes. And when my teacher was like wandering around, because I think I'd finished my math work in class because I was a terrible student. So I'm like, I'm done first. And I'm like, yeah, that's reflected in your grades, kid. But she was like, so what are you reading? And I showed the book and I think she confiscated it. Because she knew what that book was. I hadn't even started it yet, so I didn't know what it was all about. I read it years later, and yeah, that teacher is a damn hero. But yeah. So let's talk about Adventures in Babysitting for a change. I mentioned that there's some stuff, as we've kind of talked about, that doesn't work today. But in other, you know, a different context, for a movie that's almost 40 years old, it does stand out as, you know, kind of checking a lot of the, I hate this term, but checking a lot of the boxes that people like to see in modern movies. You know, you've got a female led kind of ensemble. You've got the movie
Ron Weasley impersonator.
a Ron Weasley impersonator, or as my wife said, he looks like the human version of Kris Kringle from the old claymation show.
but
Santa Claus is coming to town, I think. That would be Anthony Rapp, who is on Star Trek Discovery now, I believe, and was also, fun trivia, was one of the people that helped bring down Kevin Spacey during
the
Me Too
movement. I remember
he was
one of the first.
Yes.
Yep.
But also, I was kind of surprised because this movie, I'm not saying the point of it, but one of the underlying themes, or at least results of it, is sheltered suburban kids go into the big scary city. And, you know, it's kind of a fantasy, so they get into some danger, but it's not like, you know, real danger. But there's a black guy who they get into this, you know, car because they're trying to escape this, you know, gunplay or whatever. And it turns out he's a car thief, you know, maybe giving into stereotypes a little bit, but then you come to find out that he's a car thief with a heart of gold. You've got a guy they run into who's, you know, he's disabled in the sense that he is missing a hand. He's got a hook. And that kind of freaks them out because I've never seen someone who's apparently missing a limb before. And they just scared each other with this, you know, hook hand attacks the babysitter ghost story while they're driving their car. It's just a lot of these ideas that seem very kind of 2022. And I'm kind of curious to see what they did with that remake from 2016, which I've never seen and probably won't on principle because I love my 87 Adventures in Babysitting.
Yeah, I looked at just like the, you know, little description of the 2016 one. It was like, yeah, I'm gonna skip that one. but I thought there was a lot of moments where I was like, this is fun, you know, and it feels like a lot of up. That was kind of the general vibe I got, similar to what you said. And I was like, yeah, there were a few, exactly the moments that you mentioned, like getting into the car. I was like, oh great, you know, here's the black guy being the car thief. But his character is much more dynamic than he is in that original scene. And he makes for a lot of like fun little moments and callbacks, which I really enjoyed. By far my favorite scene in this movie, and it is not close, is the Blues Club. like I don't think I've ever seen a scene that made me smile ear to ear from front to back like that. I was so enthralled, and I was like, how stupid is it that they run into this Blues Club and they're like, we just need to get out, and the band is just like, you gotta sing the blues. It's just like, that is such good and terrible writing at the same time. And I was just like, okay. And then they started singing the song and I'm just there like smiling like an idiot. And Aaron is like, what is happening right now? And I was like, they're singing the blues, baby. And like the song is so fucking silly and fun. And it's just like the crowd getting into it is kind of just like, I don't know. It's very blues to me. It's like, you know, the whole idea behind the blues, I think, is that everybody can relate to a struggle that is shared musically. And I think that the origins of the blues have a lot more, you know, to them back in history. But like modern day blues, kind of just like they're one of the great equalizers. And it was just sort of silly to see that come to fruition. And it was when it was at that moment I was like, oh, this is not the movie I expected it to be. I was kind of like, you know, I thought it would be a series of stumbling into crazier and crazier stunts, and it very much was that. But the set pieces they made out of it was just kind of like a joy to watch. And that particular scene just got me. I got. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, it's just, you know, the there's subtext to that scene, whereas I think today it would have been made into text writ large, all caps.
Yep.
they would have milked it. You don't have to say, you know, today there would have been like some, you know, who are these, you know, crazy white kids in this, you know, club and all this other stuff. They address that in the moment where Kris and the gang are up on stage getting ready to sing Babysittin' Blues. And Daryl, the Anthony Rapp character, who's like the annoying best friend, he leans into the microphone and says, ain't no doubt. Oh, no. That may be the whitest thing that anyone's ever said in the poorest imitation of Jive ever. But yeah, it's all there. And the audience is not with these kids until they see that they're really, you know, again, trying to communicate something authentic. And then the band just steps in with this great, you know, riff, and they make a full-blown song out of it. And yeah, I was I was like crawling back under my bed because I'm like, I forgot how much the beginning of that scene hurt. I was so uncomfortable. Yep. But then by the end, I was like, fuck yeah, everyone would be standing up cheering and celebrating these kids. Why not?
Yeah, it's funny because Aaron and I, when like and we hear a blues song come on, I get up in arms because I have mad respect for the blues just as a genre as a whole. But the 12 bar blues, which is a very like kind of rigid song structure that has lived for hundreds of years at this point, I find very boring because, again, it like has not changed much. And I get so angry because I'm like, it's just so lazy. It's just not fun anymore. And there's tons of value in it, musically speaking. But when it came on here, I was like, nope, I'm in. Because like, because what's funny about the 12 bar blues is it's so accessible. It's that same, it, you know, it always, not always, but it often begins with that, you know, and everybody can kind of understand it. And that's what's so universal about it. And I think that was necessary for the scene, right? To kind of unite these kids with the community that they didn't really understand. So yeah, that, I mean, that scene just, it's everything to me. But this is unlocking that thought I locked away earlier. I'm going to pull and jump to the train scene. Do you remember our chat about planes, trains, and automobiles?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember we had it. The specifics are a little hazy.
That's
but
all
go ahead.
I need. Yeah, it was only like, what, 2 years ago?
Oh my God. Yeah.
So there was a, there's a scene in that one where it's John Candy, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Steve Martin, and one of the characters is on a train on the L. I was like waiting to talk to him. And I remember griping that the L doors would have closed and the train would have left by now. Like, they don't just wait for somebody who's standing looking at somebody. Those doors fucking closed in Adventures in Babysitting. And I was so happy. This is one thing that Chicago movies, like, I all look to see if they get it right. And it's the stupidest thing, but it eats at me. And I'm like, those doors need to close because they're not waiting for anybody. And sure enough, they closed. And I was like, somebody gets it right. And that kind of busts out into, you know, sort of a larger theme, which is Chicago movie. You know, I think that living here like this, I feel like the city is often misunderstood and sometimes misrepresented. Sometimes we will hone in on a specific community within the neighborhood and they can do that to great effect. And I was very worried going into this that it would be, you know, kind of a vilification of the city. And I think that, like you said, it kind of starts out that way, but it really subverts that trope because these kids are sort of coming out of their shells and getting a glimpse of something other than the suburban, you know, life that they've experienced. And I love how that's kind of tied in at the end. And this is not a very overt message. I think it's very subtle and you know, have to pick up on it by a careful reading of the film. But at the very end, they all say how it was one of the best nights of their life. And I think, yeah, there's a certain element of friendship and camaraderie that they built. And it's very much one of those films where people who normally wouldn't hang out are getting to know each other, which I find very endearing as a trope. But it was also like, they understood a part of their community that they hadn't really explored before. And that was a bit uplifting to me because I think those kinds of stories, though they can be a bit rote, do have a lot of value in them if done the right way. And I think this sort of approach to it is really interesting. And as a Chicagoan, I appreciate that part. Also, I couldn't name the building with the diamond top on it, but it's iconic. So
that is, I looked it up because I never remember the name of it, but it is the Crane Communications Building. I'm glad you
brought
that up.
There it is.
We'll get back to the Crane Communications Building in a second, but
and
Hans
Gruber, of course.
That's the Nakatomi Plaza, and that's in Los Angeles.
Fair.
Anyway,
look on your face says it all.
I just wanted to mention I think you're right to a certain extent about Chicago and the way it's portrayed in this movie, but it is also, I mean, yeah, it's a city like any other, right? It's got its, you know, great points and its bad points and its interesting points all in between. I think that's something that is really captured here in this film, but it is kind of interesting that they do kind of hint that there is a seedy, dangerous underbelly that is only hinted at here. For example, when they're driving that stolen car that our car thief Joe Gipp has, you know, boosted, and the kids are just kind of along for the ride, Chris is like, look, if you want, just we didn't see anything. Just let us out here. And he says, in this neighborhood, shit, I wouldn't get out of the car in this neighborhood. One of my favorite lines of all time. But yeah, I mean, it kind of hints at this, this underbelly of violence without getting into actual gunplay. I mean, I thought it was kind of cute that the gangbangers, like they looked like almost like the Sharks and the Jets.
Yeah.
Because aside from the two lead gangbangers who you kind of believe, like there's a Hispanic guy and a black guy, you look behind them and the rest are out of like central greaser casting from The Outsiders or something, and they all look like they're dressed kind of like in Michael Jackson outfits. I don't know what gang those
like
are supposed to be.
Theater kids
from.
Trying to act imposing. Like that's
yes.
And this is coming from a theater kid who did that in high school. Like, you know, it's very hard for a suburban kid into theater to look imposing to literally anybody.
Well, and that's why I was surprised they didn't have any weapons. Not saying you should have had a weapon, Cole. I mean, they had like the switchblades, right? But, you know, I didn't see it. The only gun I saw in the whole movie, I saw a couple. The Mr. Pruitt, who was our
truck driver, weird guy in the train station.
Who looks oddly like my neighbor down the street. And I was like,
might be him.
Was he an actor 35 years ago?
Now, here's the thing about that train scene is, it chronologically speaking, it comes after the blues scene. So I, as a viewer, was convinced they were going to dance. Like, I was certain that these gangs were going to dance battle. This is not a bit. I'm not riffing. I actually thought that was going to happen. And because I thought that's what type of movie this is. Like, the unexpected is what to expect. And it, like,
what, South Side Story? Is that what we're talking about?
I've seen like people perform on subways and stuff, and I was like, oh, they're gonna like dance it off and then they're gonna have the kids decide who wins. I would watch the hell out of that movie, just saying. But not that the train scene has anything wrong with it. It like it didn't do much for me, but it wasn't like it detracted from the movie by any stretch. I just thought they're gonna dance and they didn't. So it's, you know, it's funny how this movie just like takes you to one place and you feel like you're on a roller coaster a bit. And I know that's a metaphor people use all the time for stories, but like, I feel like you're on the Iron Wolf. If you ever went to Six Flags in the Iron Wolf days, where you stand up, you're strapped in and your head is just bah, 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 against the straps and it hurts. And you come out of the roller coaster like, that hurt. Let's do it again. That's kind of what this movie feels like to me. Like, there were elements that hurt, there were elements that felt thrilling, and I was kind of like jarred at the end of it, but I didn't hate it.
Well,
and now the Iron Wolf has become Goliath, which is an exceptional roller coaster, should note.
Well, that's good to know, because I think I went on the Iron Wolf once and I got my head banged around. I'm like, but this was 10 years ago, so I was already pretty much an old man. I'm like, I can't do that again. So yeah, let's talk about the crane communications building.
Yep.
What I picked up on this time, and I hadn't before, was the geography. I like that for the most part, this movie, it feels like they're going from place to place, but it's somewhat realistic. Even if it's not necessarily true to the geography of the city, it feels like you're going from, you know, the underpass where the tow truck picks them up to they drive into like this, you know, neighborhood, and it all seems to make sense until the big bit where the car thief, or the chop shop owners, essentially, they get a hold of Sarah, or they're trying to, and they start chasing her, and she looks and she sees the diamond building like in the distance, and the next shot she's running into the like through into the lobby of that building. Now, if you know anything about cities, if you can see pretty much the entire building or most of the top of it from where you're standing, it's really far away.
Correct. But this, she had roller skates. She had at least one roller skate at this point.
One roller skate, sure.
Lawyered.
I'm just but we didn't see her coasting through the doors on that one skate. That would have been pretty amazing. But yeah, I'm just like, no, that whole sequence on the crane building, that would have taken place at dawn, maybe even noon the next day, if she had to run that entire distance.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's frankly flabbergasting that they all of this takes place in one evening.
Yes.
Have you ever had a damaged windshield, Ian?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you're frozen.
Oh, no. Am I back?
There, now you're back. Have you ever had a damaged windshield?
I have.
And how long did it take to fix?
Well, it depends. If you go to Safe Light, which I don't think they had back in 1987 and not in the mean streets of Chi-Town, it took like, you know, an hour. But I know where you're going with this. They get a bullet through their windshield. And by the time they go to pick up the car, like maybe an hour and a half later, it's completely fixed.
Well, not only that, but it's like, I don't know a lot of mechanics, but I would assume that many would not just repair a car on the promise of being paid by somebody else later. Like, your car's damaged, you bring it to the mechanic. Like, it was just so funny to me that they get there, the car is repaired, and he's like, you owe me now. And I'm like, I don't even know who owns this thing. And it's just like, I know that the movie has set itself up to be so ridiculous that this doesn't really matter, but these little details, I'm like, okay, like, sure, whatever.
Let's talk about Mike Todwell then. He was the Chris's asshole boyfriend who bowed out on their big fancy date night because his sister got sick with the flu or something, so he had to, you know, be home with her to babysit, if you will. During this whole night of hell, Chris sees, actually I think Daryl notices first, that Mike is in a French restaurant with another girl who's not Chris. And
sacre bleu.
Yeah, right. It'd be funny if it was the same restaurant that Ferris Bueller's dad was hanging out at. But no, but the thing is, like, if you're looking at the timeline of this, this happens towards the end of the movie, which means it's almost midnight. And like, it's not like the restaurant's shutting down. It's in the full swing dinner service. Yep. And it's packed. Okay, Chicago is not New York, right? This city shuts down at like 8 p.m.
Especially right downtown there.
Right.
It's funny, the neighborhoods are what stays open late.
Yeah, it's
where really people live.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just another, you got to suspend your disbelief, or maybe you don't if you're 10 years old in 1987. Like, oh, that's how it works. That's why high school is ruined for me, because I believed everything about Saved by the Bell.
That's our next series is Suspenders of Disbelief, where we come in suspenders and talk about all the shit that doesn't track in movies.
Can we do it all in an Urkel voice?
Yep. Did I do that?
And no, we won't. Let me just clarify that. That is not going to happen, Cole.
Damn.
So, yeah, I know. But it is another nice scene where, again, Brad stands up for Chris's honor and, you know, calls Mike Todwell a loser. And he's like, I'm not going to stoop to your level. And Daryl says, but I will. And I love that he just kind of kicks him in the butt.
Yep.
Which is maybe a clever callback to when he talks about how Mike the year before had kicked his ass, which, you know, usually means beaten up. But in this case, Daryl literally kicks Mike's ass into the table. Yeah. And then he just kind of, everyone leaves and you kind of see in the background, like straightening up and, you know, I'm done with you, broad. But was this before or after? I can't remember the sequence of events, the college scene, the frat house scene.
It's the college scene, and then they see Mike at the restaurant. I believe so, because it would make sense narratively, right? That she meets this guy that kind of shows her something a little bit different. Sarah has to use the restroom, and she leaves the skate there, and then they go, and they must be, who gives
I don't know, because I feel like, because she was really receptive to Dan, the guy that she met at the frat house. I feel like she, well, I don't know. I watched this movie two nights ago, which might as well have been like, you know, 6 years ago, because I'm you know, tired. But no, I love this. I love the music in this movie. You know, it's all like, you know, soundtrack, you know, songs, but some obscure songs. The song they play at the frat party, I think it's called I See My Future in Your Eyes.
Yep.
I've never heard that song anywhere else before, but I love it here. I love the bit where Chris is dancing with this frat guy who offers out of the goodness of his heart to give her $50 so she can go pick up the car. And then Brad is off watching them and kind of like wistfully like, oh, that's the girl I'd like to be with, but at least she's happy. It's just such a nice moment. And if you're an eagle-eyed fan of the TV series Melrose Place from the early 90s, which I know you are, Cole, right?
Oh, yeah. I love Mel is my favorite character.
No, not Mel and Rose's Place. It's Melrose Place. Although I would watch Mel and Rose's Place. That is like it sounds like a diner sitcom. But no, Elizabeth Shue's brother, Andrew Shue, can be seen in the background as one of the other like partiers
Oh,
at this
really?
club during the slow dance scene. I've seen this movie like a dozen times or more in my life, and half a dozen of those after I became a Melrose Place fan in the early 90s, and I never noticed. I had to freeze frame the magical high definition Blu-ray and be like, holy shit, that's Andrew Shue. Very strange.
Yeah. I mean, let me talk about that party scene briefly because I think I've been to one frat party, but I've been to many frat adjacent parties or parties
What
similar
is
to that vibe,
what's
college
the
parties, I'll
distinction?
say. But college parties that take place in a house that is not a frat house, turns out they're
Okay.
very similar to frat parties.
They just don't have the Greek letters outside, right?
Yeah, that's literally it. I've never been a huge partier. The idea of drinking as a sole form of enjoyment just does not click with me. And it didn't in college, which did wonders for my social life, as you could probably imagine.
That's why we relate together, Cole. We're
But
teetotalers.
yeah, I'm thankful I got out of that little hole of, oh, everybody needs to drink all the time. But if there were live bands playing that quality of music at frat houses, I would have been there all the time. And here's the thing is I was looking for that suspenders of disbelief moment. I was like, yo, I hear horns, but I don't see no horns. And then I saw a guy playing the trombone and I was like, this frat party went all out. Holy shit. That like if I could hire a band like that to just play at my house, which I know I could, but like I guess the solution is I should do that, right? Like just hire a wedding band to come play my house. But I was like, that is and that kind of is part of that thread of musical identity to the movie, because you have the blues scene earlier, and this movie very clearly has an appreciation for music and its impact on people. And I think that is not a, like, they pull on that thread, right? But it's not the main story thread by any means. But I really appreciated it because the soundtrack is really good. The scene with the blues club is amazing, and so is this one at the party. And I just love when a movie has a carefully honed musical identity. Like Guardians of the Galaxy, I think, is one of the gold standard examples of this. Just like they know the vibe they want to achieve and the music that will do it. I think it speaks to the power of music and to the power of these creatives who can pull the right type of music at the right time and put it in a movie. And to me, it makes a movie more memorable. Like I will remember both of those scenes for a long time, and I will not remember many of the other ones. I've already forgotten them. I do remember the escape from the car operation scene, which is just like, it's like, oh, this is a heist movie now, and then they go to the blues club. So, it's like I said, it's the Iron Wolf. It jerks you back and forth. Also, I'm so sorry that I've invested so heavily in this Iron Wolf metaphor, a roller coaster that only existed in Gurnee, Illinois, and that closed multiple years ago. But I hope listeners will resonate with it.
Well, it's just like Adventures in Babysitting. This movie's 35 years old, and it's very specific to Chicago, but I think it has sort of universal appeal. I really love this movie, and it's something that even though there's parts of it that make me a little bit uneasy watching now, I'm like, yeah, this still holds up. It still takes me right back to where I was as that little kid watching this movie. Like, I wish Chris Parker was my babysitter, not just because it was the lovely Elizabeth Shue. I also had a crush on Sarah, the little girl, when I was 10, and that's okay because she was also 10. None, to be clear, none of those feelings while I'm watching the movie, as a 45-year-old man.
Has that
But
actress gone on to do anything?
she's been in a few things. I actually was looking up, the kind of the Where Are They Now cast, and she's been like a few things. I don't know. Like recent, but yeah, Keith Coogan, who played Brad, he's done a bunch of stuff. And he, as I mentioned before, I think we got going, he was in a movie a few years after this called Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, with Christina Applegate, which is equally amazing. We'll have to talk about that at some point, but yeah, it's he plays a very different kind of character. He's like the slacker, stoner, long haired, you know, metal freak in that film. But I think we can wrap it up. I do want to close with the closing scene. They get back to Oak Park. Everything is fine. They do the whole Ferris Bueller thing where the parents are coming home. It's a race against time to clean up the house and everything. And nobody
just cleaning up the kitchen counter. Like, that's the only thing she cleans up.
Well, but that's where the most of the damage had happened, right? The spilled noodles and all that other stuff. But I had never picked up on this, but at the very end, Dan, the frat guy, shows up in the driveway with Sarah's, you know, missing roller skate, and, you know, and I ask Chris out, and they have this kiss, and you see Brad like look watching them from the window, and then he kind of like pulls the blinds down, but he does it really slowly. And I said to my wife, I'm like, and that was the moment Brad decided to kill Chris and Dan, and they were never seen again.
Adventures in Murder.
Oh, there you go. That's the sequel. But
it was a close to the movie. It was, you know, it was a moment, and I was just like, it felt, to use an Elizabeth Shue pun here, it felt a bit shoehorned in, the whole love story. I suppose she needed somebody to wake her up from this, you know, nightmare that she's been living with her boyfriend. But the frat guy seemed like a bit of a stretch to me. I was like, okay, cool. But I did love, like I said earlier, the end of the movie where they all kind of realize that, like, we are different. It's kind of like a Breakfast Club moment, right? We are different, but we can be friends. And I always appreciate that type of message because, you know, in real life, I've always strived not to, like, you know, distance myself from others just because they're different. It's much more fun to learn from people and connect over those differences, rather than just kind of like separate yourself. And when a movie can, even if it's really on the nose, can hit that, you know, it's really fun. It's refreshing.
Well, you mentioned the Breakfast Club. It pretty much taken right from that is Brad at the end when they're on the bedroom. He's like, so Chris, if, you know, on Monday morning, if you go back to ignoring me in the halls, I think like that was something Anthony Michael Hall had said to Molly Ringwald at the end of Breakfast Club or something. And it was pretty much the same thing. Like, I don't want to ignore my friends or something. But yeah, so it's a lovely picture, and I'm glad that you liked it a lot. I was kind of nervous about what you might think of it.
I mean, the ones you're nervous about are my favorites.
Well, it's also, we've talked about a lot of heavy, kind of like big, important movies this year, and we're going to close on one next month where we talk about Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers for Page to Screen. So I figured I just want a random kind of fluffy bit of nostalgia and see what you make of it. So I appreciate you going on this adventure with me.
It was a great time, and I'm looking forward to the ever slow conversations to be had with Treebeard and The Two Towers.
I'm working my way through it, man. Wow. But anyway, Cole Rush, do you have anything to pimp out while you're here on the show? I know we mentioned your websites earlier before, but is there anything you want to draw people's particular attention to that I can link to below?
I recently did a piece about my five favorite fantasy companions. The furrier and fuzzier, the better. So if you head to tor.com, it's over there. And feel free to drop a comment with your favorite. I'm sure that I missed plenty, but I featured my favorites. So lots of great stuff coming up on tor.com. I recently had 8 pitches approved.
Wow.
Which is, usually I do 2 or 3 at a time, but my editor is going on vacation. And I was like, I want stuff to work on while you were gone. So lots of really fun stuff. And most of it won't come out until our next episode, so I'll save it for then.
Awesome. All right. Well, I'll definitely link to Tor and Quill to Live and all that good stuff. And Forbes, of course. So yeah, thanks, Cole. I got to get back to work and also to reading that damn Lord of the Rings book. It's great, but it's a bit much. But yeah, thanks, man. And we'll catch you next month.
See you then. Peace out.
All right. Bye.